From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Fashion designer, stage performer, and television personality Isaac Mizrahi has dressed Meryl Streep, Michelle Obama, Hillary Clinton, and a whole lot of runway models, and a whole lot of regular Americans. He's been at the center of the couture world, but also in the thick of the off-the-rack world, with his own line of clothes at Target and now his own show on QVC. Now his life's work is on display in a new exhibit. This hour on Point, Isaac Mizrahi on fashion. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Have you followed Isaac Mizrahi through the years from the runways to Target and now QVC? What's your question for fashion designer Isaac Mizrahi? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we will look at shady fashion advertisers and sellers on Facebook. But first, joining me from New York is Isaac Mizrahi, fashion designer, TV presenter, creative director of XL Brands. He stars in Isaac Mizrahi Live, a call-in home shopping TV show that airs weekly on QVC. He's a judge, is a judge on Lifetime's Project Runway All-Stars, was a designer for Target from 2002 to 2008. He's the subject of the 1995 documentary Unzipped and author of How to Have Style. You can see some of the highlights from his collections over the years at the new exhibit at the Jewish Museum in New York, Isaac Mizrahi, An Unruly History, which is open through August 7th this summer. You can link to images from the exhibit at our website, onpointradio.org. In New York, Isaac Mizrahi, welcome. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. It's a pleasure to be with you.
It's great to have you back. We've missed you since our last conversation. Mm-hmm. When you stand back and look at what is something like 20 years of your work here on display, What do you see? What are you thinking when you look at your own body of work?
What a good question. I have to say, you know, it's not the easiest thing to look back at your own work. It starts as this kind of tedious bore, you know. I mean, looking
been
at these
there, done
clothes.
That.
Yeah, and also, it's not the least painful thing in the world to look at your own work. I will say one thing. I began. There's a big wall in the opening of the show, which has become this crazy like color swatch thing. It's all these swatches. I don't know if your listeners could go online and have a look at that image, but originally, I was thinking of it as this kind of timeline. And I was going through all my paper ephemera of notes and, you know, art announcements and things that would tell the story of my inspiration and my past. And it just became too painful to do that. I just could not do it.
Because this is really interesting. Why do you find, do you think, and I'm sure you're not alone in this among designers, artists, radio hosts, looking back on earlier work can sometimes be painful. Why exactly?
Well, I mean, like, I'm not even talking about like radio hosts or designers or artists. I think like, you know, the average kind of accountant or housewife or something, looking back is not the easiest thing in the world, you know?
But these things inspired you at one time, you know? You would think that might last.
Oh, but it just is so sad to think of the passage of time in this way, you know, and how like and how remote all of that is at this point, you know. And it also kind of brings up this thing. I'm sure this is not the place to talk about it. But, you know, the idea that I think we're so Google oriented that sometimes if you Google something and it's not online, then it doesn't exist.
Yes,
you know?
True. These days.
And
true.
That makes me very kind of fatalistic. And, you know, that's not a great place to be. So it's painful. But then what happened was, you know, looking back sort of all of a sudden went from being very tedious to becoming kind of like if you can what I managed to do is I made it objective, you know, and it became almost like a research project, you know, and not necessarily about me. It was about making this exhibit. So it was became very interesting, engrossing, as though I was looking at someone else's history, you know. And the minute I approached it that way, it became almost interesting. And then it became really interesting and fascinating, you know. And then I began to learn things. Things I can't really put into words, but things about my own work and about myself that were illuminating about the future and about the present, you know? I guess I am not one who likes nostalgia. I'm not one who likes to look back.
So. But here you've got a retrospective, so deal with it, right? Deal with it.
Oh, my gosh.
You earned it. You deal with it.
I know.
You know, and there's such a marvelous collection of things here and such a range, dressed made out of pieces of Coca-Cola cans, fashioned off of Desert Storm, sort of military presentation from that time. I mean, if fashion, in a way, is a dance between a designer and women or men, it's also a dance with the times, the culture, what's going on around us. I mean, when you look at the at this collection of your work, do you see not just clothes or you know, a certain design, but do you see something about the times in which those different pieces were created by you?
You know, it's interesting because when I presented it, I had one feeling about it. And I mean, I still have the ultimate idea at the base of the whole thing, right, of the body of work. But when I read the reviews, it was very interesting because it wasn't reviewed by fashion critics. At that point, it was reviewed by art critics. And so their perspective was a much different one, and one that I really liked
and
appreciated.
In what way, Isaac?
Well, you know, I mean, they kind of looked at the art of it and not necessarily the fashion of it, you know? And I did love that a lot of the critics wrote about the political kind of balance of the work, right? And I got to tell you, Tom, you know, I think this is true, again, about all people and not just artists, you know. I think it is about this instinct that we, you know, we live our lives and, like, you know, the way a dog is sort of bred, like a collie is bred, or, you know, I have sure, a collie mix. And, he lives to herd sheep, I guess, you know. And he was bred for so many centuries to do that. I feel like when I look back on my work and I look at the Desert Storm thing and I look at the Coca-Cola dress or the Baby Bjorn dress or whatever it is that you're looking
at. It's
beautiful,
sort of red. I think it's satin, but it's got a sort of a little pouch right attached to it in the front for the infant.
Right, exactly. When I look at that work, I get in retrospect that it had this kind of good political balance, or bad, I guess, to some people. But you know what I mean? There was a balance to it.
It was informed.
But I promise you, it was informed, yes, but it was all instinct. It was all instinct, like the collie or something. I just went by what I was thinking about women at the time, the integration of that thought of, I don't know, for instance, Desert Storm. I just thought, oh, am I shallow? I guess so. But guess what? They just made up a new camouflage in beige because it's, you know, they're hiding
desert-y.
In desert. Yeah. And I thought that was fascinating. I thought it bore kind of, you know, mentioning in fashion at the time.
It's become ubiquitous since then. You can find that kind of little beigey green checked camouflage everywhere. Home Depot.
I know. You know. I know. I know. But you see what I mean? When it was introduced, I thought it was fascinating, you know, like history told in textile design, right?
We've got callers for you already, Isaac. Isaac Mizrahi with us from New York, and Linda's calling from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Linda, you're on the air with Isaac Mizrahi.
Hi, Tom. Isaac, I just wanted to thank you. I almost have a tear in my eye saying this. I'm not a fashionista. I'm 66 years old. I don't shop on HSN. I'm busy, whatever. But you as a person, through your whole time designing as an artist and designer and also a creator of consumer products that work for people, I just have admired you from afar for so long because your authenticity comes through. And I guess I just adore it. And as a gay male, successful gay male in our world, the way you express, and plus the when you talked about the collie was very interesting because I thought he's also expressing his political upbringing. He was, I don't know who your family was, but I think he was from an informed family, a family that discussed things, a family that let you live and have your ideas. I think, I hope, and if not, if it's something you acquired as an artist, because an artist's drive can't be stopped, really. And I just want you to know I appreciate you as an icon of our culture, a very positive and special one. And
oh, gosh, that means, thanks. Linda, that means the world to me, really. And I love that you, I love every single thing you just said. And I can't dwell on it because my head will explode. You know, it'll make my head very big. But
it is pretty beautiful. Linda, I'll read for you from the Times Review. This is raised in Brooklyn, began his education at Orthodox Jewish Yeshiva, where he was bullied for being overweight and effeminate, then went on to New York City's High School of Performing Arts, Parsons School of Design. What about your upbringing in terms of the collie that you've become, in terms of the instincts that you've got, Isaac? How does that work. It wasn't always easy.
No, no. And I will say that, you know, the biggest piece, I think the biggest kind of pivot of my life was when I went from this kind of yeshiva background. And I have to say it was very, very big of my parents to, like, just allow the thought of my going to this arts high school, you know, public arts high school in New York City. You know, then sort of working with this one teacher at the time, Miss Kanowitz, who actually coached me and helped me get into that school. And then I went from a yeshiva, an Orthodox yeshiva, to High School of Performing Arts on 46th Street.
Wow.
You know,
That's a jump.
It was culture shock, let's face it, you know. And that was, I think that was the biggest pivot of my whole life. And I will say, you know, I am such an advocate for that thought about public arts education. I feel like it really made my life seem, for one thing, like it made every single one of my aspirations seem tangible. You know, it was like, here's how you do it. Here's how you read Shakespeare. Here's how you listen to, you know, Mozart or Bach or something, right? That formative experience in the middle of New York City at the age of 13, right? It was, I think, the biggest part of who I am as an adult now.
You were 26 when you came out with your first collection. That's young. Okay, so, I mean, things get younger and younger. I don't know. But where did you get the propulsion to just go straight in and do it?
Well, Tom, I mean, if I knew that, I would, you know, have the secret to the youth spring.
The miracle of life.
Exactly. Right. The one great thing about being young is that you don't get that failure is such a bad thing, right?
Yeah, just go do.
You just go and do it. Exactly.
Isaac Mizrahi, please stand by in New York. We're so glad to have you with us today. Big new retrospective exhibit at the Jewish Museum in New York, Isaac Mizrahi and Unruly History. And it is unruly in a quite glorious way. You can join us today. Has fashion and clothing grown more or less important to you in your life? What role does it play? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with fashion designer Isaac Mizrahi about a life in fashion, fashion's now, and what fashion means, what it's really all about. Isaac Mizrahi joins us from New York. There's a big retrospective of his work on right now through early August at the Jewish Museum in New York. It is Isaac Mizrahi and Unruly History, and you can link to some images from that at our website, onpointradio.org. How do you picture the role of a designer like Isaac Mizrahi? Isaac Mizrahi designed clothing, bedding, and more for Target from 2002 to 2008. Here's an ad from that period.
I'm Isaac Mizrahi. Wait till you see these clothes I've designed for Target. Chic, affordable, divine.
It's like Fifth Avenue meets Main Street USA.
Fifth Avenue to Main Street USA. And here he is just last month on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. Colbert showed him a photo of Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders shaking hands. Bernie's in a suit. Hillary's in a navy blue, loose-fitting top and slacks. The top goes down to just above her knees.
Who wore it better? Can you tell me who wore this better?
Well, you're putting me on the spot.
A little bit, yeah.
I'm going to say one thing. Hillary has some good hair, finally, after these years. And, you know, Bernie is coming away from the men's warehouse thing, slowly. We're sort of talking him off the men's warehouse ledge a little bit.
That was funny. Isaac Mizrahi on the spot there on the Colbert Show. Maybe away. Since we've got a guy and a gal right next to each other here, give us a little makeover advice for Bernie and Hillary. What would you say to them if you were a fashion advisor to each of them?
You know what? My biggest advice to both of them would be not to get a stylist and not to make it high on their list of priorities.
Does that mean never change?
Don't change. Yeah, it's too, like I said, it's too weird,
yeah,
right?
Agree.
Especially if, like, at a certain age, you just get a pass, you know?
Right. And good, because we have more important things
yes.
than what they've gone on. Isaac Mizrahi, what is fashion? What is it? What's going on? What is fashion?
That's a good question, too. I mean, you know, I always think that it's this kind of like every so often you kind of look in the mirror and you get bored, you know, and you start reimagining and relearning how to look in the mirror and what you want to change, you know. And I have to say that I don't – I mean, my idea about fashion is not necessarily – a kind of thing where you go from like a maxi skirt to a mini skirt and from really high heels to flats. You know, I don't do that. I think about it as an evolution, you know, and I do think about it as a political expression as well. And by that, I don't mean like, oh, I'm voting for Hillary, you know, mm-hmm. but I mean, you know, the politics of living your life every single day. You know, I have to say the thing as a fashion designer who looks at collections occasionally, I don't really look at other collections that much. But what offends me the most is when people pander or when fashion designers pander, when they give.
What is that? What amounts to pandering? What constitutes pandering?
Pandering. Well, when they give a woman something she's seen already a million times before, you know, yeah. I mean, that's fine, but you don't need to show it to everybody as though it's something fabulous and new because mm-hmm. everyone knows it's not. And it makes me very mad because I feel like there's nothing more offensive than being bored, you know, because I think of it as this really kind of holy thing, right? I do. I think like it's more important ultimately than we give it credit for, you mm-hmm. know. It's kind of exactly like eating, you know, except that you don't need to change the way you dress in order to stay alive. I mean, that's mm-hmm. one difference, but mm-hmm. it is this kind of sensual thing that is like, you know, as adults living in the bigger world, we have learned to take great pleasure in, you know? Mm-hmm. And so when you bore me with the subject, I don't like it. That's the most offensive thing. Because even if I'm not going to wear it, I like to be amused when I look at images. And by the way, I think fashion, more than anything, generates so many images, you know? Like, there is so much fashion photography. I think more than any other subject, yeah. people photograph fashion. Right now, it's about looking at Instagram at clothes, mm-hmm. food. I mean, that's what you look at a lot, mm-hmm. you know?
Sure.
And so with all of that imagery out there, you have to be careful. And I'm trying to, like, demystify the subject for a woman, you know, or for a guy, right? It's mm-hmm. nothing more than boredom. If you are bored, move along. You know, that's my theory.
And if you get on the wrong side of Isaac Mizrahi on that front, he'll let you know. Here he is from 2012 Project Runway All-Stars giving contestant Kenley Collins a little feedback on the dress she'd designed.
I love the spirit of this dress. I have one challenge for you, darling. Like, try not to do a dress that looks like this next time. You do it again and again. You know, that's
my
really?
One
thing.
Oh, really? Okay.
I mean it.
Just laying it down, and he means it. Here's my question. Okay, don't bore Isaac Mizrahi for sure. He'll let you know about it. And yet, it's not just random change. Something drives fashion. What drives the direction of it?
I don't. You know, I have to say, there are so many opposite things going on now in fashion, which I love because, again, it's not so boring, right?
Describe them. You know far better than me.
Well, you know, there's a whole bunch of stuff going on right now that's realistic. You know, it's like a good plaid skirt just below the knee with a sensible shoe. I mean, that people are kind of getting into that look again in haute mm-hmm. couture, right?
Okay. Does that mean traditional when you say realistic?
Yes. Or no, it's kind of like you want to call it like librarian or something.
Okay, okay,
you know?
Yeah, okay.
And we're loving that because it's the opposite of what's been going on with all of this over-the-top kind of stuff. But then the opposite of that is taking place where people are like getting, you know, like even taller on their heels and even skinnier and they're you know, they look like they look like they're sort of morphing into another species, do you know? Mm-hmm. And so there's that as well. I have to say, you know, like, can I, before I go another sentence.
Yes, please.
Can I just say that, mm-hmm. like, you know, here we are on, like, the smartest show in the world, right? Talking about, like, one of the silliest things in the world.
Well,
you know?
Is it, though? Is it really? I mean,
we're
wrapping
not.
Our very selves one way
I know.
Or another in fashion every day.
Well, I the thing I don't want to do is offend that many people. You know, I'm like almost embarrassed that I am this obsessed with the subject, you know.
I do feel
that it propels us, you know. It propels us. And it is so much bigger culturally than we ever thought. And one good thing is that we're noticing it now. I feel like the responsibility of a fashion designer is greater than ever, you know. And like,
what does that amount to? When you say responsibility, yeah. I don't even know what that means exactly. I mean, you look at a lot of these runway shows, they're spectacular, they're breathtaking, but responsibility? Yeah.
Well,
to what?
Because you're kind of informing a woman mm-hmm. or a man, but I'm talking about like being, you know, a designer of women's clothes.
Yeah.
You're saying, please look like this, look in the mirror and see this, you know, mm-hmm. if you possibly can. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, like, if the image is like too ironic, mm-hmm. it gets a little offensive, you know? Mm-hmm. And I know that there are no fashion designers out there who mean to be offensive, but the occasional show where the girls are just too skinny, it's like, yeah. And I know we're supposed to like overlook that, but it doesn't work for me. It just doesn't, you know? And or something where a woman is being pushed into this direction that just looks too objectifying. Mm-hmm. I mean, I do get that here we are at 2016, and it's like a tongue-in-cheek objectification when
you
a
mean
woman wears
sexual objectification.
Yeah,
I guess.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes, yes.
Just too sexy, you know, over just out
it's
there.
It's just mm-hmm. it's I get that it's supposed to be ironic, and I get mm-hmm. that we're supposed to be in control.
Yeah.
But it gets like at some point I think there's a responsibility, and you have to throw it off. Like sometimes. If you're going to do that, you have to come back with something. You can't just leave her out there, you know, to be that ironic. So that's the responsibility I'm talking about. And I go back to this instinct mm-hmm. thing again, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. where like, you know, playing around with these images, you better have your instincts in line. You better have all of this knowledge, all of this information, you know. It's very, very important.
I think it's a plenty worthy subject. If we travel the planet to study anthropology, we better be able to just turn around and look at what we wrap ourselves in every day. Isaac Mizrahi is with us from New York. Wanda in Central City, Kentucky. You're on the air with Isaac.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
And what an honor to talk to you and Isaac Mizrahi. I'm a 68-year-old retired librarian, and I'm finding that clothes are becoming more important as I age.
That is interesting. Why? What's going on, Wanda?
I feel that clothes, you know, big clothes open doors. Like when you present yourself well, you'll get treated better, especially, you know, as older women in America are, I don't know, I'd say devalued, you know, when you don't have that mm-hmm. youth mm-hmm. and that bloom that you had.
So buck up with a good presentation.
Yes, yes, yes. You know, I try to start off with, and I don't have a big budget, so I do consignment shops and thrift shops, and I try to dress fashionably, you know, keep my hair androgynous, teeth white, chin up, you know, that type of thing.
Wow.
But I think clothes are becoming more important.
Wanda, you're on
and
it. You're so on it. And I'm so glad you've called. That's just terrific. And thank you very much for that. Isaac, what about different ages and fashion? Wanda's 68, and she's getting more into it.
Yeah, I love her for that. Yeah. I mean, I hope that I can live up to that when I'm, you know, at that – when I reach 68.
Mm-hmm.
That's only honorable. That's a great thing. I had a friend who worked in a museum. She works in the museum, like costume world, mm-hmm. and she used to say, she's a French lady, and she used to say it's only polite to look good. You know, like it's only polite.
It honors the other person. You're saying it honors
exactly. Mm-hmm. It honors whoever you're in the room with, and you know, when I think about Wanda, kind of thinking more about clothes, I go, that's exactly right. But Wanda, the thing I would like to say is that there, just so that you understand, there are like, you know, 20-year-olds who want to look more sophisticated. You know what I mean? So it's like, mm-hmm. I don't think that there's one person on earth who isn't considering or taking great pains to not consider, you know, to ignore. So it is, I think, a human condition. And I think that like, I'm going to like consider what she said because – you know, recently I've been like letting things go a little bit. You know,
okay.
I'm eating a lot and I let my hair go here and there. And
it's
I think, oh, you know, a shoe with an orthotic, huh?
Okay. It's a confessional suddenly. Good.
It's a confessional. But, you know, I think Wanda has kind of inspired me because especially it's like, you know, you can't let it go. But can I just say one more thing,
yes,
Tom,
please.
And to Wanda? And this is like where it starts splitting hairs. You know, I am not a big advocate of face work I am not a big advocate of plastic surgery. I sort of don't believe in it because I feel like, you know, the minute anybody touches their face in any way, I can tell, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that, going back to what my friend was saying, that it's polite to be gorgeous,
mm-hmm.
right? I feel like it's polite to like, you know, not do too much to your face. I mean, if you can kind of get to a place where you feel great about yourself, you know, I'm saying plastic surgically and all, like then go for mm-hmm. it if it makes you feel more comfortable. But like the minute it becomes like altering and the minute sort of, you know, like your eyes look completely different and you look like a different person, then you're kind of not giving me the, you know, the consideration that I'm looking at you.
The respect,
you know what
of
I mean?
Being genuinely yeah. present.
Like, who do you think mm-hmm. you're fooling is basically mm-hmm. what I'm trying to say. And then, like, when people's boobs go from, like, you know, a tiny little cup to a giant size. I mean, it's there's something offensive and, like, speaking of misogynistic, you know, and speaking of responsibility, I just don't – at this point anyway, mm-hmm. I don't mm-hmm. find – I'm not a big advocate of surgery unless, you know, I don't – I'm just not.
Somehow, so there, I got the feeling from Wanda in Central City, Kentucky, that she's on your beam there. She's looking for fashion, but I somehow don't feel her heading off to the plastic surgeon.
It could be. I mean, you know, I think that more than trying to maintain a youthful appearance, mm-hmm. I think that one should keep striving for an interesting appearance, you know. And so Amen. That's why I brought up these girls at 20 who want to look older or more sophisticated. Mm-hmm. Nobody – so that's why and that's my reasoning for the anti, you know, sort of surgery thing, because I don't feel it's right to keep harping on the youth thing.
Yeah,
I think maybe Wanda is onto something where, you know, it's like a little bit more effort into the clothing aspect or the hair. She's thinking about androgynous hair and white teeth. Good for her. You know, that's a smart balance to me.
We're talking with Isaac Mizrahi. He joins us from New York. Elaine in Omaha, Nebraska. Elaine, you're on with Isaac Mizrahi in New York.
Hello. When I look around in the stores, I see a lot of beautiful clothing. But when I look around at the people, I see torn jeans, athletic shorts, shredded clothing. It looks like it all came from a very bad Goodwill store in Africa. And I understand the democratization of clothing, of fashion, which to me means that even poor women or people of limited means can buy beautiful clothing. It should not mean that we all go to the lowest common denominator so that we all look as bad as we can look. Even when I go to church or the symphony, I see the ugly clothing, and there's no place you can go to avoid it anymore. So I'm hoping that fashion designers will raise the bar a little bit so that we can all go around looking as beautiful as we possibly can.
Elaine, let us pick it up. I'll come right in and say I want to plant the flag for the beauty of African textiles and many fashions I've seen there. But you're talking, okay, a Goodwill store. What about when you look around, just the hoi polloi and how people – and we all know what Elaine's talking about.
Yes.
Now, look, people have a lot of things to spend money on, and clothing isn't necessarily for everybody the most important thing. But different cultures do set the needle in different places when it comes to their presentation. Where do you see ours these days?
Well, you know, I mean, it's such a big world, and it's getting bigger and bigger every second, you know, because there aren't rules, you know. Elaine is talking about a kind of – you know, looking at things that are deconstructed and getting more and more and more deconstructed, right?
Mm-hmm. The torn jean look and all that.
Torn jean, mm-hmm. and it gets even more torn every time we mm-hmm. look at it, you mm-hmm. know, or like a distressed kind of a situation. And, yeah. you know, I'm not exactly the biggest, like, sort of advocate of that either, frankly. I don't love distressed clothes or torn clothes. Mm. I did a collection a long time ago that was kind of affected by light. It looked like, you know, kind of light bleached clothes. Mm-hmm, and that mm-hmm. was a whole thing I was into about color more than anything else. But mm-hmm. I would agree with Elaine a lot, you know, but that's not to say that we're right, Elaine. It's like, you know, we have our ideas about irony. We have our comfort levels with that subject. Whereas, like, you know, if you want to talk about the individuality or something of fashion, we have to allow for other perspectives. And, you know, if there's a humor to it, if there's a kind of beauty to it, then I am all for it, even though I wouldn't probably wear it. But, you know, some people do a very good job at this deconstructivist kind of distressed thing. And I don't disagree with it. I don't disagree with it, you know, but I wouldn't wear it. So if does that perspective? Is that a good perspective?
We hope that speaks to Elaine in Omaha. We've got a lot more to dive into with Isaac Mizrahi. There's a big retrospective of many years of his work. It's on right now at the Jewish Museum in New York through early August. How do you picture the role of a designer like Isaac Mizrahi? Do they decide what we wear? Are we puppets on their strings? Or are they somehow responding to, guessing what we want? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point with Isaac Mizrahi. We'll be right back.
This On Point podcast and following message are brought to you by Goldman Sachs. For answers to the world's most pressing economic questions, from finance's role in addressing climate change to the implications of central bank policy decisions, tune in to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, the firm's podcast. Each episode features in-depth discussions with some of the firm's leading experts on the markets, evolving industries, and the global economy. Subscribe to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs on iTunes, Stitcher, or SoundCloud, or listen at gs.com/podcast.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with fashion designer Isaac Mizrahi, TV presenter, creative director at XL Brand. You can see him on QVC with his show there, Isaac Mizrahi Live, call-in home shopping on QVC. He's been all over, from the highest runways to the aisles of Target in his years. Fabulous retrospective on his work, and it is eye-popping stuff. There's just beautiful, beautiful design here, and also design that has moved right across the country, far, far from haute couture. You can link to some of the images from this presentation at the Jewish Museum in New York at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can join us. What's your question for Isaac Mizrahi on your spring and summer wardrobe, where it's all going? What is fashion really about? Isaac, we've got Ajua calling from Miami, Florida. Ajua, you're on the air with Isaac.
Hi, Isaac. I'm so happy to talk to you.
I'm thrilled.
So I got introduced to your line when I was coming out of college, and when you had items in Target. And I have to tell you, you helped mold my fashion as a young college graduate going into the professional world. The simplicity of your clothing, timelessness, classic, love it, love it. I still have pieces from Target in my closet that I refuse to get rid of, even though I'm out of the sizes.
Thrilled to hear it. I
want to say thank you so much. You've contributed greatly towards a generation of kids. I don't know if you're aware of what your impact is on the 32-year-olds.
That's great.
You've been great.
Thank you.
That's
Ajua.
Incredible. Thank you so much, Ajua.
Thank you. Thank you very much for calling. You are in her closet. Derek in Charleston, South Carolina. You're on with Isaac Mizrahi.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to just put forth the point that I see fashion as scaffolding for each person to construct who they want to be that day. So when I put on my clothes at the beginning of the day, I'm choosing which of the dozen or so people I'm going to evolve into a little bit that day. And by putting on that costume, it helps me be honest to the people I'm around as to who I am and who I'm becoming. But more importantly, it helps me be honest to myself into the kind of person who I really want to be. Thank you.
Thank you, Derek. That's interesting. Sort of the flag you're flying that day in your fashion.
It's a big part of it, obviously. I mean, that's a very big part of what it is. He's so right. Derek is so right.
It's a way to signal that we can wear. Charlay in New Orleans, you're on with Isaac.
Hi, Isaac.
Hi, Charlay.
I'm calling to get your perspective on the effect of social media on designers, because as a fashion consumer, I'm seeing that many people are taking their cues now from bloggers and kind of reality personalities, and I wonder what effect that has from the top in fashion.
That's a very, very important thing to point out about how fashion has changed over the past, say, 30 years or 15 years, is that social media runs the fashion business. And I am all for that because it's interactive. You know, I that's the best part of the world we live in right now. It's also like the worst part, right? It's the worst part and the best part. I remember what was better about fashion before social media was the fact that, you know, things were secret up until the time they were shown. And so there was an actual reason to go to a fashion show or to wait for something.
And
right,
excitement.
For a season. Yeah. There was an excitement, exactly. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, you kind of – if you're on social media and you follow a certain designer, you know exactly what they're doing at all times.
As they're like, cutting it, as they're drawing
as it. As they're cutting it, as they're thinking it, you know? And so, like, it just is the way we digest things. And I think that is somewhat worse, but it's also, I think, in the long run, better, you know, because, again, anything that demystifies this very mystifying thing is good for me. You know, that's good for me. I mean, like, it doesn't necessarily add up to, I don't know, to like, because for years and years, fashion designers were like, oh, how can we sort of confuse this lady or something into buying more clothes, right? Like, here are different ways we can be rude when she walks into the store. We can keep things from her. Yeah. So there's that, all of that is, seems to be going away now with social media, which for me is great, you know? But I do miss a little of the surprise. I will say, I remember this one story, speaking of surprise, when I was a kid. You know, my best friend Peter worked at Dior in Paris, and I used to go there a lot to visit him, etc. And I was sitting waiting for him across the street at a cafe on the Avenue Montaigne at the fabulous Maison Dior across the street. And I remember the models emerging that were doing a kind of a preview photograph sitting for Women's Wear Daily. And this is literally like 25 years ago or something. Okay. And they were dressed in these giant robes. And I thought, how fabulous that Dior is doing robes for their fall collection, right? Yeah. But then after they set up the lights, the robes came off and there were the dresses beneath those big graduation robes. And they took the pictures in a second and the robes went back on and they bundled the models back inside the house in case there were spies from Saint Laurent or from wherever it
was. The opposite of our way now. Yeah.
I know, I know. And so – and I'll never forget that story. And that illustrates, I think, how different it was in those days. And it's hard for us to remember, but that's what it was.
The hidden can be so alluring. There's so little that's hidden. Now, what's coming, Isaac? What do you see coming in terms of fashion in, I don't know, the next year, the next stretch of time? Where are we headed?
Well, I think that what's important is this polar thing. Like, this is fabulous and the exact opposite of this is fabulous, right?
Such as, like what?
So, yeah. So, like, you know, I'll tell you what I've noticed about right now, coming out right now, is, like, we've been so color saturated all these years, like, for the past 15 years. And let me tell you, Tom, I mean, I remember when I started 30 years ago, you could not sell an orange anything. You could not sell yellow. Yeah. You couldn't sell that. It was either black, gray, navy blue, and that was it, right? But now, over the next – over the past sort of whatever decade, you only sell yellow now, you know? But I've noticed that a lot of very smart runways, it's about kind of like black. And just for a minute as a palate cleanser, I kind of like the thought, you know? Like, just for a minute, we're going to go to black. – It's like a sort of a little respite from all the color, so we
even
can come
you,
back
the man who has wielded color like nobody's business, ready for a little rest, a little pause,
a little on that. Bit, yes. In the long run, you know, I keep talking about like the opposites, like this kind of really minimal thing, and then this incredibly eclectic thing. You know, that will never change because I think you have people on Earth who migrate towards simplicity and making things simpler. And you have people on Earth who migrate towards, you know, grand kind of embroideries and embellishments, etc. And you've so that's never going to stop.
You've talked about women going toward perhaps a more formal look coming in, men maybe toward more frills.
I do think so, yeah. I think it's going to get more formal. And I'm pretty excited about that, both for men and women, only because, like, you know, it seems that the world lives now in this kind of bubble of computer. Like, you're sort of at home with your computer for so long in these sweat clothes, in these wonderful, comfortable pieces
suit,
where
whatever,
you kind of – yeah, exactly. And you get to layer them and look kind of cool that way and mix kind of things. But I feel like as a response to that, over the next 10, 15, 20 years, we're going to kind of reimagine ourselves in a formal way. Like, when we go out, it's going to be a greater, bigger deal, you know?
Ladies and gentlemen, you heard it here. You heard it from Isaac Mizrahi. A big retrospective of his work is at the Jewish Museum in New York through August. So wonderful to have you with us, Isaac. Thanks for coming back again. Thanks for spending some time with us.
Well, it was really fun. Thank you, Tom.
Fun for us, too. Thank you so much. Isaac Mizrahi, you can link to images from the retrospective at our website, onpointradio.org. In a moment, Shady Retailers of Fashion on Facebook. This is On Point. You may have seen them, ads for adorable dresses and outfits on Facebook for outlandishly low prices. The catch, if you order what arrives in the mail, if anything comes at all, can very often look quite different from what was advertised online. Not dazzling, but dowdy, baggy, a mess. And what's more, an investigation found sites offering these clothes are linked to one of China's richest men. Joining me now from New York via Skype is Sapna Maheshwari, business reporter for BuzzFeed, who broke the story. You can link to her investigation at our website, onpointradio.org. Sapna, thank you very much for being with us today. What's going on?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Things are going great. How are you?
It's well. What's going on with this? I guess it's a kind of a straight-up scam online.
Yeah. So essentially, women all over the world have been seeing these ads for really cute items on Facebook for the past couple of years. And it turns out as they've ordered them, they're getting all kinds of stuff from China, if they receive it at all, that really looks nothing like the pictures online.
Now, when you say nothing like, I've got spread on the table in front of me a lot of these, and I would have to say that they look something alike, but the pictures that they market with look pretty fabulous, and the clothes, they look like a terrible approximation made without any care for craftsmanship or fit or anything, like just big bags with something like the original picture.
Right. It's almost like a caricature of what you thought you would be getting. So what happened is a lot of these places are taking pictures from women's Instagram, different fashionistas, fashion bloggers, big retailers like Free People or Urban Outfitters, and then they're modifying them so that they're not traceable. And then what they're sending are these kind of terrible approximations of what women are seeing online.
So it looks terrific in the photograph, and the prices are as beguiling as can be. Give us some examples.
Exactly. So there might be something like a $250 Free People swimsuit. Suddenly, it's appearing on one of these sites like Dress Lily or Rose Gal. A woman in Minnesota sees it and says, wow, that's fantastic. It's only $15. And then what she gets is just absolutely not that garment. It's very thin, or it's child size. A lot of the times an extra large will arrive, you know, fit for a five-year-old. The material will be thin, and people have reported that there's a terrible smell, sometimes like formaldehyde, like it's really come from a factory that no one really knows, you know, where it is.
So something may come or may not, but if it does, it's so trashy that it, I mean, have you seen many of these that someone would actually wear? They're almost beyond the limit of what you'd put on.
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, women can't wear it. There's definitely some reports of people saying, you know, it is wearable or salvageable. But broadly, women want to return these garments. And that's where they really run into trouble, because for many, they'll have to return the items to China, which one woman told me two coats for $100 would have cost her $84 to ship back.
Is it criminal to deliver a sloppy version of something that looks great in a photograph?
Well, it's hard to say, because when you're actually getting the good, you can't claim fraud outright. If you're paying with PayPal, there is a policy that says you can argue for a refund if something is significantly not as described, but there's a whole bunch of catches that come with that in terms of proving, you know, what you got versus what you thought you were getting. And because these companies are based in China, they're not subject to the same rules that retailers in America are subject to. So that's where women are truly losing their money here.
But these ads are all over the place. Where do they show up most frequently, Sapna?
Really on Facebook. And it's interesting because women sort of have a sense of trust in the ads that they're seeing on Facebook, especially because these places are advertising aggressively under a whole bunch of different names, advertising the same goods. And so through Facebook, that's how women have gotten to these sites. And ultimately, Facebook, it turns out, wasn't really screening for a lot of these advertisers and kind of didn't realize how much these sellers were taking advantage of their system to target women all over the world.
Give us some of the names of the outfits that are advertising, the brands they put forward.
Sure. They're called Rose Gal or Dress Lily, Rose Wholesale, Choice, but spelled C-H-O-I-E-S, mm-hmm. Fashion Mia. A lot of them sort of mimic popular startups in the U.S. Like there's one called Maud Lily, which sounds a bit like the U.S. Commerce site Zoo Lily.
Mm-hmm.
And again, like that.
Who's behind these? Have you been able to winkle that out?
Yeah, so that was really one of the big things we were able to discover. So at least 8 of the biggest sellers that behave like different sites online, they have different Facebook pages and followings, they're all linked to one company in Shenzhen, China, that's known as Global eGrow. And that site is part of a publicly traded company, which is chaired by one of China's richest men. And we mostly figured that out through trademark filings in Europe and in the U.S., and that was, you know, a big wake-up call for a lot of consumers who had no idea, you know, how they were connected.
This is Yang Jianxin is the rich guy you're talking about. He's on China's rich list. How do you shut down something like this, Sapna? Because, you know, if people look and they say, wow, that looks really cute, and it's $15, and they send off the money, and back comes something just I mean, the photos that you've got here, what's advertised and what's delivered are just outrageous, how crummy this stuff is. How do you shut it down?
Well, that's a tough part. Facebook said that they are looking into ways in which to identify companies that are leaving customers overwhelmingly unsatisfied. So one way is to get these sites less in front of consumers. There are ways legally to shut down sites that are truly blatantly stealing images and selling counterfeit wares, but that's a little bit tougher. So right now, the best recourse we have is to teach consumers that they've got to Google these places, they've got to look up reviews and maybe reverse search on Google outfits that they're interested in. But really, it's just kind of raising awareness. It's tough to shut down.
And what's the best sort of tell that what you're looking at you may not get? Is it the price itself? If they're offering you something fabulous for $9.99, give up?
Yeah, I think it's just asking yourself, is this too good to be true?
Sapna Maheshwari is a business reporter for BuzzFeed. I'm glad that you put it right out there because a lot of people have bitten on this, and that's a lot of cash flowing off for not something very good in return. Keep it up, Sapna, and thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Abigail Collins, Julie Jopp, Bailina Mata, Stefano Katsonis, Sarah Platt, Caitlin O'Keefe, James Ross, and Abby Ruzica. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.